call the meeting to order. I apologize. We're just a little bit late in starting this morning. Ms. Knuth is not going to be joining us. She is unable to join us. Mike Rothman, Commissioner Rothman, is on the phone. Hello, Commissioner Rothman.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Very good.
Yeah.
Right on key. Thank you.
You bet.
And I understand you'll come and join us for the second half of the agenda. Is that correct?
That's correct, for the climate adaptation stuff. Yeah.
Thank you. And again, Eric Tomlinson also is not able to join us this morning. And apparently Matt is not or will be late. And I see John Saxog is not able to join us, at least at this time. I'm not sure if he's coming or not. So with that, I will call the meeting to order. And shuffle some papers here. I would ask for a motion for the proposed agenda for the January 20th, 2016 board meeting to also include the minutes of the December board meeting. Unfortunately, I was not able to be here, and Brian, thank you very much for managing interesting, I should say, meeting. So my opportunity to be gone for that was perfectly timed.
Well, you're more than welcome. I'll fill in any time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brian.
I move approval of both.
There, you've heard the motion to approve the agenda in addition to the December meeting.
Second.
Minutes. There is a second. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Let's start with the introductions, and why some folks may wonder why we continue to do this time after time after time, but we are video taped, and so we want to make sure that folks that are watching will have an opportunity again to understand who is serving. So, Kristen, please.
Thank you. Kristen I.D. Tollefson. I'm a citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Brian Napstead, Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Michelle Beeman, Deputy Commissioner for the Pollution Control Agency, sitting in for Commissioner Stein.
Adam Dunnick, Chair of the Metropolitan Council.
Dave Fredrickson, I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture and Chair of the Environmental Quality Board.
Will Soyford, Executive Director of the Board.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of Transportation.
Thank you, one and all. Let's then, pardon me? Oh, John.
John Saxog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Thank you, John. I had you absent without leave, AWOL, for a minute here, but you redeemed yourself.
Just in the nick of time.
That's right, that's right. I will go again to the agenda, the chair's report, and what I would just mention that, and I know that Will is going to talk a little bit about this, but I can't help but steal a little bit of his thunder. We had an EQB retreat last week that was attended by literally everyone, and I want to thank Will and the staff for pulling together just what I thought was an excellent opportunity for us to spend time on the mission, the vision, and the work behind us, the work that we're doing today, and certainly the work that lays in front of us to continue to work on. So thank you for that. We also had an opportunity to discuss climate change with a pre- and a post-meeting, pre-Paris and post-Paris. And again, Will, thank you for pulling that together, and I know that you're going to comment just a little bit about that as we move forward. We are planning at the Department of Agriculture to host a pollinator summit in the month of February. Summits, I think, are kind of the hot item nowadays. We have a variety, starting with Tom Landwehr and the Pheasant Summit, and we've morphed into a variety.
Forget the Carp Summit back in 2011.
Carp Summit, that's right. We surely did. I've forgotten the Carp Summit.
I think Will
just
organized
something
it. Blame Will for the whole summit thing here.
He's always carping about something.
Yeah.
Ooh. All right. And I look forward to that. Certainly, we're going to have a discussion on our multi-agency efforts to protect and enhance pollinator habitat. And that's something that we're doing from an ag perspective. So we'll be hosting the summit. We have it's by invitation because we won't have enough room to put everyone at the table, but we're expecting between 100 and 150 people that will be participating. And I know that Commissioner Zelli has a huge interest in this, and
I'm there.
I've been putting the pressure on to get you over, you notice, and you have committed to participate, so I am eternally in your debt.
It's in my calendar. I'm committed.
Right. Very good.
We're not holding a concrete summit, so I'm going to...
No concrete summit.
Asphalt?
Well, that's the
don't
possible.
Go there. with that, Will, I'll ask for your executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to reiterate our appreciation for all the members and staff who participated and helped plan the two events last week. You know, as you all know, this is the second of a series of meetings we've had with a delegation that went to Paris to represent Minnesota at the Global Climate Talks. And it was a successful international event, and we've been trying to better understand the linkage between the progress that was made in Paris and what we're doing here in Minnesota. So the dialogue about, you know, where we go here in Minnesota next and how we develop policy to try and align with global efforts will continue, and we just appreciate everyone's participation in that meeting. You know, we did have a board retreat that afternoon, as the chairman mentioned. I just, again, wanted to express our appreciation for everyone attending that and thoughtfully contributing, and just let everyone know that kind of next steps, we're fleshing out concepts and things that we heard both in the breakout tables and in the broader discussion, and then I'll be reporting back to the board at our February meeting with a little bit more detailed work plans to kind of wrap up 2016 and into 2017 based on strategic goals and other priorities that you all had mentioned. So thank you for your input into that, and we'll report back here next month. A couple reminders for upcoming events. The Minnesota Water Resources Center is hosting their annual Climate Adaptation Conference, and that's January 28th. That's next week at the Minneapolis DoubleTree. If you haven't signed up, I would encourage you to do so. And as most of you know here, the governor announced his water summit coming up here on February 27th. That's going to be at the Intercontinental St. Paul Riverfront Hotel. The registration's full at this time, but there is a waiting list. And so if you are interested and able to attend, I would encourage you to. Anna Henderson and Eric Dahl and I are supporting the effort by participating on the planning team. It's helping to advise the governor's office on the structure and the different breakout sessions and what the agenda looks like, along with a team of other agency staff. And so,
the anticipated number of attendees.
Yeah, we're thank you, Mr. Chair. We're expecting probably about 1,000. The capacity is really around 1,000, and so we're really hoping to engage a broad section of Minnesotans on a whole variety of water topics. And so if you have thoughts or recommendations or questions, you know, please feel free to follow up with me directly. But that's coming up here in a couple of weeks. And one of the breakout sessions, which actually will be is relevant to today's topic, is going to be on adaptation. And so we're working closely with Paul Moss and the ICAT team to try and refine the agenda for that session. And, you know, I just want to thank Paul for his generous support to this effort, too. A couple other things to just mention. As you know, we proposed a rule under the good cause exemption to amend our a category for recreational trails at the end of last year. It was not approved as proposed, and so we've made some changes to our proposal based on comments from the administrative law judge, and we're going to try and utilize that exemption to move forward the rule here again now in the next couple of weeks. So we'll keep you posted on that. We're filling a communications vacancy right now, and at the open period ended yesterday, so we'll be looking at candidates and moving forward with interviews probably in the next couple of weeks. Hope to make a decision on that pretty soon. And then our next meeting is scheduled here for February 17th, and we're going to be talking environmental review for most of the meeting. So,
thank you, Will. I know that a few meetings ago we asked that each person at the table, particularly the agency people, bring forward, if you don't mind, some things that you are working on, just to continue to keep us all abreast of that. And I don't know, I can, Tom, are you prepared to, of course you're not, but you're awfully good at it.
You keep looking at me, Mr. Chair, so I feel like I better be either be prepared.
And, you know, if you're not, that's fine also,
wing it.
If you're not.
You know, just a couple of things, and, you know, this won't be necessarily new information for a lot of people, but we did have on Friday our annual DNR roundtable. We bring together about 300 stakeholders interested in fish, game, and water, in particular ecological water resources. Had an opening comment by the governor, closing comment by the lieutenant governor, and a number of sessions in the middle. And really good discussion. Pollinators was actually one of the breakout things that we had a discussion of. Focus of it was complexity of natural resource management. We used Mille Lacs as kind of a poster child for that, but looked at other things like deer and groundwater, and many of the issues we're involved with. So very, very good meeting, and a lot of good press came out of it as well. We continue to move forward on the adequacy determination for the PolyMet project, of course, and we still have a timeline posted on the web on that. We're still operating within that timeline, and we are also analyzing comments now from the Fargo-Moorhead diversion, and we expect to have a final out on that sometime in the first half of 16. So a lot of our work continues on environmental review. And I think, Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Brian from Bowser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's probably two initiatives that I'll discuss that are important initiatives going on within Bowser right now. One is the One Watershed, One Plan initiative. As many people are aware, right now water plans or comprehensive local water management plans are due from a variety of governmental units, primarily counties, water management organizations, and watershed districts. Those plans in the state of Minnesota at this point in time number about 240. There are about 89 watersheds in the state of Minnesota. And when I say watershed, I mean a geographical feature on the landscape where all the water flows to one area. The One Watershed, One Plan initiative is designed to move water planning away from the governmental boundary unit to a watershed unit, manage the water hydrologically. So it's a good initiative, and it's coinciding with the Pollution Control Agency's effort to do the watershed restoration plans, the RAPS programs. So the One Watershed, One Plan, at this point in time, the program is beginning to roll out. As you may be aware, Bowser has been underway with five trial One Watershed, One Plans over the last year or so. The legislature authorized implementation of it statewide, and we're looking at right now probably the next, taking applications for the next six or seven or so projects, depending upon what funding is allowed to handle. So that project is moving forward, and I think it'll bring a lot of value to discussions, even discussions we have today about climate change. Managing water on a watershed basis is going to be much more applicable than managing it on a governmental boundary basis. The other thing I would just mention is much discussion has taken place regarding the governor's buffer initiative. At this point in time, the DNR is working steadily on getting the buffer protection maps out. The public waters maps are out as we speak. And I believe, Tom, it's July.
We should have the final of the other legal ditches and benefited areas of maps done.
Right. So those maps will be coming out. They'll be coming out to the local governmental units, whether it's a watershed district or whether it's a soil and water conservation district, to review and comment on those maps as to their accuracy, whether something was not included that should be or something was included that shouldn't be. They will be verified, basically ground truth, by those local governmental units. And then Bowser will begin setting policy as far as what's necessary. The statute describes what's necessary fairly clearly, except for the category called other waters. And we'll be establishing policy once we understand what those other waters are. Those policies will be established by the Bowser Buffers Soils and Drainage Committee, and those meetings will be open to the public. I guess that's all for now.
Excellent. Thank you. Michelle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what Commissioner Stein would have had me say, so I'll just wing it. The two, as you might guess, the main things that we're focused on most immediately are related to water, both planning for the water summit, very engaged in that, and the number of breakout sessions and the number of topics. We have a lot of staff and a lot of technical information that we'll be feeding into that summit, so we're planning on that. And then, as the governor announced, the big bonding initiative related to water infrastructure. And so, along with Dr. Ellinger and the Department of Health, Commissioner Stein and agency staff have been working very hard on both getting ready to package and promote that, but also doing a lot of listening sessions out around Minnesota, continuing to do that, to hear from local governments about the stresses and the pressure points they're feeling related to water infrastructure. So that's been a big piece.
Very good. Adam? Anything from Met Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, yes. A couple months ago, I talked a little bit about comprehensive planning beginning about 3 or 4 months ago, back when system statements went out in the fall, and I just quick update on that. It's about an 18 to 24-month process in sum, in total, and in the coming months, we're partnering with folks like Urban Land Institute, the Humphrey School, and some other folks to do workshops around the region about sustainability, water planning, climate adaptation, and kind of what that means in terms of city's comprehensive plan. So that's a little bit of an update. Look for some of those public events to be around the region near you soon.
Thank you. Dr. Ellinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday, the department issued a health advisory about the Zika virus, mosquito-borne illness, so for particularly treacherous for pregnant women, because it's a human-to-mosquito-to-human transmission, and it affects the developing brain of children. So the CDC had issued a health advisory earlier in the weekend, and we followed up with one yesterday advising women who are traveling to the southern climes to be careful. Also yesterday, in collaboration with the Department of Agriculture and the Pollution Control Agency, we sponsored an antibiotic stewardship summit, recognizing that it was one of the One Health kinds of initiatives where the human-animal-environment interaction is affecting antibiotics and the resistant organisms, and that's one of the growing public health problems that we have in this country. So we were developing a strategy for that. And then just we've been responding, you know, related to the water issues, the lead poisoning issues that are occurring in Flint, Michigan, really highlights the importance of maintaining the infrastructure that we have for a lot of our public health needs, particularly water. And that's just a very tragic situation in Flint, Michigan, and we will not hear the end of that for a long, long time. So it just reminds us that we have to invest appropriately in things that keep us all healthy.
Commissioner Zelli.
Thank you. We're fully engaged in every 4 year update on our long term 20 year plans, most notably the MNSHIP, which is highway investments, but it really identifies how we think about the family of plans, freight plans, port plans, pedestrian, bicycle, how they all kind of work together. So we're trying to be more multimodal is the jargon, rather than just have discrete plans. So we're in the middle of that effort. Obviously, one of the key issues for us is making the case for the legislature addressing transportation funding, both transit and roads and bridges, and that is a key topic that everybody in the agency seems to have role in. I am inspired by listening to Secretary Fox from the U.S. Department of Transportation, who is somewhat unleashed by having a five-year transportation bill passed this last month, and maybe because he has 8 months left in the Obama administration, but he is being much more overt in what resonates with us at MnDOT, and that is transportation is not about throughput. It is not about making cars go faster. It is about placemaking and having tentacles that are meaningful toward the lives of Minnesotans, and in our case, Minnesotans. And so that is something that we find very much in congruence with how we're thinking about our design of our projects, that rather than building barriers, we're actually helping mitigate and open up toward different neighborhoods in the metro area, but also really fits to our Main Street projects in greater Minnesota. That this isn't about just state highways for cars. This is about what we can do to enhance both retail and health, only because Dr. Ellinger keeps telling me we are, and I believe him, I listen to you, Ed. And that's kind of gets me to the subject of pollinators, kind of fits into that idea that we are one of the biggest landowners after DNR and others, but that we have a stake in more than just the roadway. So we're actually getting a broader vision as part of our planning process.
And we're pleased that you're going to join us at the Pollinator Summit. I know that you were in D.C. and spent some time on that issue with
right.
the Department of Transportation folks. We're looking forward to your comments. And full disclosure, I went 100 miles an hour one time just to get that out of my system. So
yeah.
I'm done with that now.
Still
so I'm
good.
Not worried about speed anymore. Whoopee.
Prospect.
I was 18, okay?
You're forgiven. But
what the heck did they have when you were
Commissioner?
Yeah. That would go 100 miles an hour.
That's like going like 150
You were just falling down.
Fell out of an airplane.
It was a 1957 Ford, if you have to know, with a police interceptor motor in it. Commissioner Rothman, after that?
It's hard to beat all that.
Did you ever go 100?
Yeah, but it was in on the road out to California where they don't monitor you very carefully.
Oh, sure.
My new Saturn back in 2000.
Saturn would never go 100. No.
But anyway.
They don't go 100.
Yeah. That thing went 115 miles an hour, so it was stayed steady. Many of the things that are on our agenda, you've already commented on. There's the COP21, which is a terrific, inspiring a lot of people aspiring to great things. We heard and debriefed from that, and I think we have, we made a note of some takeaways that I think are going to be important that we do to keep people engaged. Second, there's the department is continuing to work on a lot of the clean energy initiatives, making sure that we are moving. Both in our resource plans as well as on some of the programs for encouraging solar development in a smart way. Not mentioned, but work that is happening between the PCA and the Department of Commerce, led obviously by PCA, is the Clean Power Plan work and the collaboration, stakeholder engagement, and all that, and preparing a draft. Commissioner Stein and I have, on a regular basis, as chairs of the Climate Subcommittee for the EQB here, met, keeping track and progress of some of the climate initiatives that we are taking a look at, some of the studies that are being done. And then this afternoon, there will be the climate adaptation thing. So there's a lot to be done, a lot that's happening. But I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mike. At this time, we'll move to item 5 on the agenda, which is the discussion, the multi-agency efforts to protect and enhance pollinator habitat. And I would like to invite Tina Markison, to come on up and present. Welcome to the EQB board. Tina, thank you for being here.
Okay, thanks.
Tina is with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Office of Environmental Stewardship.
Thank you for agreeing to listen to pollinators today. As you've already heard, a lot of agencies are already dealing with pollinators, and it was just brought to my attention really through some of the things that I've been thinking in the back of my head, but also I sent this presentation out to Department of Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture, and Bowser just to get their feedback on this before I presented on it. And it was a really interesting dialogue that happened because I got presentations back from from each of those entities as well. And they said, oh, that was a great slide. Can we take it and stick it in ours? And I said, well, you know, that's great information. Can I take that and stick it in mine? You know, and so there was this sharing of pollinator presentations that happened.
At the Department of Agriculture, we have an R&D department, and it's called rip-off and duplication.
So it was just very interesting to see how, you know, each of us were talking about this. All of us are talking about it, but we're all talking about this piece over here and this piece over here, and nobody's really talking about the big picture of it. And also, when the agenda went out, I received a phone call from MPCA, and they were just looking for some information, like, well, what does PCA do about this? And I said, well, that's kind of the problem, is that, you know, I know what transportation is doing. I know a little bit about what DNR is doing. I know a little bit about what Ag is doing and Bowser. But I really don't know who else is doing something or who should be doing something as part of the cabinet members. And as the presentations will show, there's some other things that, you know, I was thinking, you know, potentially Commerce, Department of Commerce might have something to do with it, or Department of Health might need to do something with it, Department of Education, you know. And so those were just kind of my brainstorms as I was putting this together, that really we're all kind of talking about it, but I don't know that we're all telling the whole picture because we don't know it. So with that, I'll just get started with this. I'm going to give a quick overview about what pollinators are, just to make sure that everyone's on the same page. And so pollinators can be simply anything that transfers pollen from one flower to the other. So you can have bees, you can have beetles, you can have, not in Minnesota, but you can have bats in other areas of the country, deer, humans, wind, rain, any of that can be considered pollinators. But really, the national efforts have really been, the flagship species have really been towards the honeybee and the monarch butterfly. And so those are the two that you'll hear most about. But in general, almost everyone is talking about pollinators when they're talking about those two things. And so you've heard, this isn't new. It's been in the news a lot. There's lots of different stories out there that have covered pollinators up to this point. And just as a side note, bee pollination is responsible for $15 to $18 billion worth of pollination for food crops. I mean, that's national, but that's a huge chunk of money as far as an ecological service that the bees and the other pollinators are providing us humans directly for with our food supply. And also with the monarch butterfly, what you see here is the monarch flyway. And the monarch butterfly, for those of you that are not familiar, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has accepted a petition to investigate the potential listing of the monarch butterfly on the threatened and endangered species list. Now, that investigation is going to take time. And so we have some time to maybe increase the amount of habitat that we have. So maybe we can positively influence that investigation and hopefully bring some monarch butterfly numbers back up. But this shows what the monarch migration looks like. There is a population on the West Coast that pretty much stays on the West Coast, but it's the eastern population over here that's really the major concern. And you see that they overwinter in Mexico, and then they make their way north, and then they for the summer, and then they go back to the wintering grounds in Mexico. And if you know where I-35 is on this map, you'll see that it's pretty much in the center of the migration area. And so that is why the I-35 corridor is being looked at as well, as far as increasing the amount of habitat along I-35 for monarchs and other pollinators. So when I was telling you about food, this is a picture from Whole Foods, and they took a picture of their produce section with all the produce that was available to us in their store. This is that same picture if you take out all of the foods that are insect pollinated. And we'd still have food. It'd be more bland and not so colorful. But you know, you really see the impact that it has on our food supply. And you know, we can process food all we want.
Can you flash back to the one preceding just to go? Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, we can process food all we want, but we keep hearing from Department of Health and others, you know, that we really need to get back to more fruits and vegetables. And so we really need the pollinators to help us out with that one. So the bees, you've also heard about this colony collapse disorder. And, it's a huge, huge issue that's out there. And there's no one thing that's causing the honeybees' populations to decrease. It's a variety of different things. There's a mite that, you know, that lives on the bees. And how do you kill an insect that lives on an insect is the conundrum that's there. Pesticide impacts. There's monocultures out there. Gary Reuter from the University of Minnesota said they ship bees from Minnesota and other areas to the almond crop in California. And he said, you know, people think, why can't we just have bees that do that? Well, if you looked at the almond crop, it's a monoculture. It's acres upon acres upon acres of just almonds. And he made the equivalent that if I were to drop you at the corner of Dan Patch and Underwood during the state fair, and I told you that you only had a one-block radius to find food, you could do it during the state fair. If I dropped you there right now, how long before you starve? And that's really what monocultures do is, you know, we've got, they provide a little bit of good quality food for a very short period of time, and then they have to be physically moved, the bees do, in order to find more forage. And so monocultures can be a detriment to the bees as well. We're moving those, and so we're taking bees from Michigan, from Minnesota, from the Dakotas, and we're putting them all in one area that is a great vector, or allows for vectors to spread diseases very well. You know, if the Dakotas were having an issue with a certain virus or something, that could easily move into Minnesota when we brought all of our bees over to California for the almond crop. But the biggest thing that the state agencies have an impact on is habitat. You know, we can provide that habitat. As Commissioner Zelli alluded to, the state owns a lot of land. The DNR, the number one, if that's correct, landowner in the state, and DOT has approximately 175,000 acres of green space along our roadways. That's a pretty significant area once you add it all up. And I think that that, and then with the outreach that Bowser has to, through the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and all of its initiatives, we really have the potential to impact a lot of land together. So I think that's the biggest thing that, as a state agencies, we can be looking at improving the amount of habitat and the quality of habitat that's out there. So I mentioned that I had talked to Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Bowser when I'm putting this together. And this slide just shows a quick brief synopsis of what each agency or entity is doing. And we're all doing a lot of stuff. We're all doing outreach. We all have publications. The DNR just had a front porch after their roundtable that specifically looked at pollinators and getting the ideas out there from the public as far as what the DNR needs to be doing about pollinators. Commissioner Fredrickson mentioned the Pollinator Summit that's coming up in February. The DNR is also holding a Monarch and Native Pollinators Forum sometime this winter yet. And so there's just a lot of efforts going on out there. And one of the concerns is we're not all on the same page. We're not all talking together at the same table as far as, you know, how does the Pollinator Summit interact with the Monarch and Native Pollinator Forum? You know, how are those working together? One of the big things that Bowser, the Department of Natural Resources, and MnDOT was able to do is we actually got together and we came up with seed mixes for Minnesota. And it's a great tool. We came up with about 30 seed mixes for Minnesota. They're all listed in the MnDOT seeding manual. I'm positive Bowser has them in a document as well. It was a great collaboration between the agencies to get together and make sure that the needs were being met across it. And at the same time, by putting these 30 seed mixes together out there on a state level, we've created the ability to have the demand in the for vendors to actually grow the stuff that we need. So we're helping out, you know, making sure that the demand is there so that our seed suppliers can actually supply the seed that, that we're actually looking for. This is just another tool that we use for the seed mix selection. One of the great things that MnDOT did is we actually took our seed mixtures and we put them into a database and then created this interface that's online. And you can actually go there and pick your site characteristics and hit enter or submit, and it'll spit you out a list of the plants or the seed mixes that'll work in that particular area. You know, that's a great tool. You know, as this presentation went out, you know, some of the other agencies were like, wow, that's a good idea. We need to, you know, be able to look at that and maybe make a link to that as well. The other thing is that the pollinator habitat that's out there, we get as Commissioner Zelli, you know, we're expanding our interests in that and outside of just pavement and those types of things. And so really we need to start looking at habitat as function. And some of the other things that, you know, the bees, the pollinator habitat, the wildlife habitat kind of come into that. But really we need to start looking at our habitat and our native plantings really as function and not fluff. Not something extra that maybe we can cut off as we need to save money for other things, is really, you know, putting that function on there. And so these native plantings provide soil stabilization. They provide water infiltration better than some of the non-native brome grasses that we have out there. They require minimum long-term maintenance, which is great when your focus isn't a land as DOT. We really want transportation. We want people to get from A to B safely. And so we don't, you know, the sides of our roads may get some minimum maintenance done to them because we're focusing on the surface of the road. And so really looking at that minimum long-term maintenance. We also use vegetation for snow control. And we can use that taller grasses the more rigid forbs or wildflowers catch the snow before they get to the road, which is awesome because we don't have to put as much salt down on that section of road. And then it also, the native trees and shrubs can enhance views that are along our highways. So there's some regional and national efforts going on right now. There's the presidential memo. So in 2014, the presidential memo came out saying that there needed to be more emphasis on with federal projects on honeybee and pollinator habitat. And they followed that up with a federal strategy on honeybees and other pollinators that came out in May of 2015. The Monarch Highway was named as part of that federal strategy, which is the I-35 corridor. And in part of this presentation, again, as I heard back from Bowser and from DNR, saying we really want to take a look at corridors. We want to look at corridors. So that's another avenue that we need to maybe, you know, partner with some of the other agencies on. And then also there's a regional governance that the DNR is looking at with 17 other states and making sure that that those are looked at as well. So as you see on the agenda, I have some discussion. When I was talking to some of the other agencies on this, you know, Department of Agriculture kind of led the way with the pollinator BMPs, with the advisory group that was formed a couple years ago, at least 3 years ago. The DNR has been working on operational orders, you know, and so really, you know, where are we at as a state? And I really would like to hear from the commissioners and the board members as far as where you think the pollinator effort needs to go. Do we need a state plan? I'm not saying that someone needs to write what DOT needs to do. And DNR, you know, we have the expertise in-house to and the knowledge to make sure that it fits with what we do. But really, how do we make sure that we're all on the same table? And how do we make sure that we're not missing other other departments in the state. You know, should PCA be involved? They have an NPDES permit that requires rapid stabilization so that there's less erosion. How does that affect the ability to put in long-term native grasses that don't establish as quickly? You know, so it's some of those type of discussions that I think are missing right now that we should really be looking at and, you know, getting together as a state. Does health need to be involved with this, you know, with the impact to fruits and vegetables, commerce, anybody else that I'm missing that was outside of my realm? So do we need a statewide formal multi-agency plan? And who would, you know, who do we get together to start working on that? So I
thank you.
Turn it over to...
Great questions that have got us all, you know, racking our brain here quickly to come up with. I think, you know, Dr. Ellinger talks about health in all policies, and I think that the pollinators in all policies might be the next appropriate thing, certainly. So, we've been joined by Commissioner Clark Sieben. Thank you. Good to see you. And also Commissioner Mossman, Matt Mossman. We asked early on if you cared to other members make some comments about some of the things that your agency is doing today. It may even relate to the issue of pollinators. So, Matt, I'm throwing you a bone here. I know you're going to be talking about pollinators.
You might be surprised, but we actually have some things to talk about at the Department of Administration on pollinators. So thank you for the introduction. So actually, we got some questions on pollinators and neonicotinoids in particular with regard to the vegetation. I think there's two opportunities both on the Capitol complex and through contracting, I think there's opportunities. So we actually went through training. I was delighted to learn when we got the question that all of our landscape staff had already actually received pollinator-friendly training. I don't exactly know who provides it, but to the extent that that's something that we can work across agencies with to do for staff that works in this area, that would be, I think, helpful. I think another thing that actually goes perhaps underutilized as an opportunity, and I have a question at the end of this actually for you, is the potential to accelerate through the state, through centralized state contracting, some where it's appropriate and where it would work effectively. Making progress, for example, putting out solicitations that specify that we wouldn't buy, we won't buy chemicals on contract, neonicotinoids or something like that, depending upon the needs of the state and the needs of the state agencies. So there might be some opportunities to accelerate things through the contracting. But my question there is, one of the things I hear from some of my folks is that the industry to some extent is still catching up in terms of labeling and other challenges that we confront in this case as a purchaser of product in order to make sure we're getting what we would prefer. Any thoughts on where that's at?
Actually, the person next to you would probably know that more about that. The Department of Agriculture, I believe it's in legislation, and I can't remember if it's statute or rules or where exactly it's at, but it says that nursery plants can't be labeled bee friendly if any part of them was treated with a neonicotinoid in the past, including seed. And so the Department of Agriculture, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the Department of Agriculture is working on a program so that they can certify stuff as bee friendly, so that can actually be a certification of some sort. So they are working on it. I know that exists out there, but you're right. There is a lag. There is this gap that it's existing out there. And I know that some of the herbicide labels are changing as well. The bee friendly is a now a, an icon on the labels that is coming out of EPA. And I can't recall the exact number, but labels are, you know, re-examined by EPA every so many years. And so it's going to take that, whatever that X number is, to make sure that the herbicides are labeled for bee-friendly or not bee-friendly or, you know, maybe potentially hazardous to bees. So we are going to have this gap in the middle of it. I actually am the person that heads up the herbicide contract for the state and with the help of Ag and DNR to make sure that their needs are met on that as well. So I'll take a look at that. I think it's up for renewal, right? Or it's going to be renewed this year. I think next year it's up for the big rebid and that kind of thing. So we'll be looking at that as well.
And I can also send information to you regarding the label issue, and I can't remember if it's law or if it was rule either, so I'll just have to double check. Anything else within the agency that we talked about a short update from the agencies around the table. Anything else on your plate that you'd care to share, or is it you have to kill us after you tell us?
I might have to kill you after I tell you. So we actually have a number of things that are going on that are of interest, I think, to this this group. And we've been talking to some of you about them, but many of you know, we put out, and Met Council did some similar work, but we put out a solar garden RFP to look at beginning to head down the path of more sustainable and renewable energy resource procurement for the electrical needs in at least the state capital complex, as well as DNR participated in that RFP. Department of Military Affairs, a couple of other state agencies were part of that process, and I think we're also engaged in a survey tool with all of you to kind of see through contracting what can be the next a next opportunity in that regard, also just in terms of use of state property for hosting solar or continuing to support progress in that industry and renewables for state operations. So, you know, I think there's actually a real opportunity for us to, I don't know that it was originally admin's role, for example, in this group, but I think there's a real opportunity for us to be helping with the state operations side of things to make sure we're aligning with a lot of, in what state government does, how we operate our buildings, et cetera, that we're aligning with the work that this group does. So, we're looking at, which many of you will hear more about in the coming months, but we're looking at eliminating, as you know, we have an increased capital complex recycling requirement in statute, and we are soon going to be moving in the direction of eliminating death side pickup. I just announced that publicly. At least piloting with that, because that is been found to be the pathway to significantly increasing the percentage of waste that avoids landfills and ends up in the recycling stream for organics and others. So we'll be working with state agencies that, in fact, there's apparently thousands of pounds of empty plastic garbage bags that we throw away each year that we think we can avoid, if nothing else, through that system. So that's a couple of examples. We actually have a number of other things that we're working on with Fleet. To work with all of you, once a year we go through the purchasing of, we make major purchases of vehicles, and so we're working with all of you we have, last year actually, we reorganized our fleet into, instead of kind of prioritizing which vehicles were lowest cost for you, we prioritized which vehicles are most green friendly for you and have focusing on life cycle costs rather than sticker price costs. So we actually made a good deal of progress last year. I think we averaged, including with some electric vehicles, we averaged for the vehicles we purchased compared to the vehicles we replaced, we improved the miles per gallon about 10 miles per gallon actually for those purchases. So we want to keep heading down that path with the purchase of new vehicles going forward. So
thank you. Yeah. Commissioner Clark-Steven.
Yes, thank you.
Any issue, you know, what you're doing or as it relates to pollinator questions, please?
Well, I would say about 90% of my time at the moment is spent on either mining workers on the Iron Range that are laid off due to mining issues there and suppliers, vendors that are laid off, or racial ethnic disparities that exist throughout our state. And so neither of those topics are probably appropriate for this venue. But in thinking about the work that we're doing that focuses on this, one thing I was thinking about during your presentation is beyond the walls of deed, beyond the walls of state government, interaction with the business community in this space as we see new business expansions occurring, developers planning new urban or rural space. How are we interacting with that community and making sure that they have access to these this information and these resources? So we could help be a point of communication if there is an interest in helping to expand some of this knowledge to the business community, making sure that they're also aware of this information. We'd be happy to serve in that capacity.
So you, Commissioner Zelli and Tina, you have developed 30 varieties of native species that will be, or I mean, you have collected 30 varieties of.
We've approved 30 varieties.
Approved.
There we go. We've come up with 30 different seed mixes.
Okay.
That can be used in lots of different areas. We have some non-native mixes and we have some native mixes, and each of the species within the mixes serve specific ecological niches. And so we have stuff for urban areas, so that we have a seed mix for like a residential lawn area that where we might disrupt, you know, a sidewalk or a boulevard that we can put in. But we also have the Mesic Prairie mix for northeastern Minnesota or northwestern Minnesota. So it really spans the there's a lot of variety in those 30 mixes that those 30 mixes really hit on almost all of our needs. And I believe the DNR may augment the mix with specific species if they're in an area, if they have an SNA that that they are requiring specific seed, they'll augment those. But it's really the same base seed mixes that Bowser, MD, not MDA, DNR and DOT are using.
Thank you. Other, Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the presentation. I really appreciate the attention that the issue has drawn. You know, we know that in Minnesota we've lost 98% of our native grasslands. You know, we've restored some more. But, you know, you think back to your school days and you read the old Little House on the Prairie and life out on the grasslands. It's not that anymore, right? It is much different now. And what we're seeing is really a symptom of a system-wide collapse, possible collapse. You know, the monarchs and the pollinators really are following the path led by the dick thistles and the meadowlarks, following the path led by the badgers and the blue-winged teal. I mean, all of these things that are dependent on grasslands in particular are really suffering. This is not a problem that is present in the forested part of the state. This is a problem that's present in the grassland part of the state. And so I appreciate the attention that is being brought to it. And I think it really does emphasize that, you know, the solution here is several fold. One is we need to protect and manage these key habitats and look at how to create more and restore them, manage them better. I think, we've got a lot of good programs in place. And as you mentioned, we've got DNR manages state land. It's not DNR land, it's state land. But we've got probably in the order of more than 1 million acres in the farmland part of the state. And so that is a large asset. And we've been looking at ways how to improve the forb complex on it, the species beyond grasses that the pollinators depend on. And Charlie, the DOT is another large landowner. And obviously, the location of these lands is important as well. You know, we've got in some parts in northern Minnesota, the state has 60% of land holdings. But in southwestern Minnesota, 1-3%. So we're not going to sustain a population on 1-3% of the property, and it often tends to be clumped. The beauty of the DOT holdings is it's linear and it's long, so it covers a long area and provides some of that ability for migration and so on. But we really have to look, you know, whatever we're doing is not adequate, right? Because we're seeing population decline in spite of the fact that we're doing, you know, really outstanding work on preserving and managing lands. We need to look at what else is going on here. And so I think we need to kind of redouble our efforts with respect to the land, managing the asset we've got, because that's our best bet right now. But look at some of the other things that may be going on. And I think only more recently have become aware of some of the impacts that possibly pesticides are playing. And you mentioned neonics, or a systemic plant pesticide that ultimately kills non-target species as well as the target species. And that really poses some really fundamental questions of how we look at that application. So I think we need to continue the coordination and the planning. I think that's really critical, so we don't sort of trip over each other and fail to miss opportunities, but then look at some of these other areas where we have not been doing so well in the past and really take advantage of the attention that's being paid and really sharpen our pencil and get to work. So appreciate the attention.
Charlie, and then Ed.
I just want to affirm what Commissioner Ledbetter's described, and also say it's such a privilege to hear you, Tina Markerson, talk. Every time I hear a presentation, I learn more. We mentioned it, but the two of us went to Washington as part of a White House summit on pollinators. And there's a number of states engaged in this process, but clearly you can feel proud as Minnesotans that we are leading in terms of DOTs in this effort. And we have a lot of attention from the Office of Science and Technology as part of the White House. And it's interesting when the chief executive takes a real interest in something, Secretary Fox and a lot of the folks at leadership within the U.S. DOT have now taken strong interest too. So, and what was also gratifying at that meeting was the number of private foundations and not just the Xerxes Foundation, but others who say, look, you know, if you can do something as a collection of states together, we will be there to support you. So we had meetings with these six states, which we are now engaging with, you know, Minnesota and Iowa are kind of more leaders. And the middle part of the country, they're talking about shortage of funding. And so we're doing our part by saving money and not mowing grass anymore. So we're saying, well, that's a start, so that's okay. You know. And then Texas actually has a tremendous history of roadside flowers. So that's just kind of already gets them into that mindset. But, you know, clearly, you know, if you're talking about the Carolinas, it's all about looking beautiful, and it's the Office of Tourism that are talking about, you know, putting annuals. And I think they are kind of gravitating toward, no, actually, this is much more than just looking pretty. And so it's a great debate, has strong support from the U.S. administration. And so what we've done and what I've done is started engaging with the commissioners and secretaries in this corridor. The idea of a monarch highway, if anything, is as much branding and awareness as it is about actual best practices. And we can, many states are, I was doing something, everybody's doing it a little bit differently. We can probably help. But the idea that there's this flyway and more of a brand awareness opportunity that we think we can be part of. And so I've met just last week with the commissioner from Iowa, and who is the current kind of board chair of our entire AASHTO national group. And so we've kind of set it as an agenda to get these states together and meeting next month in Washington. So we're going to talk about how we can get an interstate MOU together to talk about how we might work. And frankly, with some national foundations, I met with General Mills a few weeks ago, and they're already engaged in this issue. They'd love to have something that's more Minnesota-based to help drive going forward. So we know that's in this state, but I think the issue goes beyond Minnesota. So the extent that we can get some federal and interstate kind of cooperation, I'm very charged up. This is something we could help move the dial.
Excellent.
My comments follow from that. I mean, appreciate all of the work that's being done. This is a, this truly is a health issue, and talking about foundations, I was mentioning after talking to Commissioner Zelli, I mentioned this when I was at Princeton talking to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is pushing on a culture of health. When I talked to them about a pollinator corridor, they their eyes lit up and say, "Well, this is truly a health issue." Which so it gets me to one point that I make is I think this is an opportunity for us to do a health assessment, our health impact assessment. Which I think would have, and there'd be some funding for this, I think, given it's a national issue and other foundations, because I don't think everybody recognizes the total health impact that is having, and certainly people are interested in jobs and they're interested in their health, and if you can, you know, link this to their health, you may get a whole bunch of other folks engaged. The other thought that I had really came about when I was thinking about Commissioner Frederickson driving his car 100 miles an hour down the highway. And I wondered how many pollinators he killed while doing that.
It was wintertime, all right.
We've actually studied that.
And that's what I was thinking, that there's...
Dave, not so much.
that you know, I'm sure there are some thoughts about, you know, doing this in the correct way to really protect folks, the little critters in the doing of this kind of project.
There's actually studies that have been done on that to see if the, you know, if putting... the pollinator habitat alongside the roads, if that's going to increase the amount of mortality to the pollinators. And what they've found is that as long as you've got good pollinator habitat over here, there's no reason for it to fly across the road over here. And so there's it doesn't really give a whole lot of just having pollinator habitat alongside the road does not increase dramatically the amount of mortality of the pollinators.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask Frederickson, why did the pollinator cross the road?
Yeah, I knew that was coming. I just knew it was coming.
It doesn't have to.
Brian, and then Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tina, thank you for the informative presentation. As I was looking at the sheet that you handed out, there's a comment on here that the monarch butterfly is a candidate being examined for the endangered species list. And that kind of perked up my attention because here in Minnesota, we've recently... I believe, completed an examination and come out the other end with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding another animal, a bat, northern long-eared bat. The northern long-eared bat suffers from a disease called white nose syndrome, and the bat has got a very large range. It's from the southern United States up through Canada, from the Atlantic Ocean over to the kind of the Dakotas area. It's just huge. The implication of having that bat listed as an endangered species in northeastern Minnesota would have been a complete shutdown of our logging industry. And it's bad enough with no taconite right now, but if you take the timber out of northeast Minnesota, there won't be really anything left there. And I think it would be useful and instructive to paint a picture of what it would look like if we don't take action. What would it look like if this monarch were an endangered species? I know when we were discussing the northern long-eared bat, we weren't able to clear our right-of-ways for new road projects because we could have had an incidental take or an accidental take of a bat, of bats near roosting trees. From a commerce perspective, what does that mean? Incidental take, while we're, you know, joking about Commissioner Frederickson's speed challenges, the bottom line is they were looking at individual bats when it came to timber harvest. And if they start looking at individual butterflies as incidental take, we have a problem now with commerce down the I-35 corridor. So, and you've mentioned herbicides, neonics, systemics. The Fish and Wildlife Service, I believe, at least from what we experienced with the northern long-eared bat, would probably be within their authority to prohibit application of those products because of incidental take. So I think it behooves us all to look at what it would look like in Minnesota if these were listed on the endangered species list, and that might motivate us to take a little more affirmative action before that happens, because if we flip over the switch to the other side, it could be a dire situation. So I think this is something that really needs to be elevated in importance, and I think we do need to take action, because I would agree with Commissioner Landwehr. What it is we're doing isn't working. Otherwise, we'd at least stabilize, and it doesn't appear to be stable. It appears to be getting worse each year.
You would suggest something like an economic impact statement.
Yes, that'd be a great idea. I guess when I use the term paint the picture, I probably was really thinking about the economic picture. There, it would have dramatic, devastating consequences if this were listed as an endangered species. Probably not just in Minnesota either.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Brian. Michelle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I really want to applaud convening this conversation here, because I think this is the kind of multi-dimensional audience that gets the thoughts going. When this was first brought to me just a couple days ago, I said, oh, this is going to be on the agenda. What is PCA's role? One of your questions. The quick, easy answer is, well, that's not really our main focus. That's a DNR. It's a habitat. It's a Bowser. It's ag. Transportation. But it doesn't take long to start thinking through the next layers down. And I was kind of intrigued, for example, by your reference to our MPDS permits. We obviously do deal with stormwater and water infiltration. And so if there is some unintended consequence or some bias built into the permit we hadn't thought about, it's only when someone else points it out and says, oh, might you look at that? That might have an impact on the types of plantings, or is there something about a BMP that you could look at that is within our regulatory world? So we'll do more thinking about that. And the other thing it just occurred to me as I'm hearing talk and thinking about land ownership, we do own, unfortunately, a lot of closed landfills. It's not a huge area, but they might be places where we can look at what are the plantings there. We own them. We're going to be maintaining them for decades. And is there something different we could be doing on that? I don't know, but it's certainly – I'm making a note. And anywhere we've got land, whether it's the Capitol Complex
or – Put them under the solar field.
There you go. Can we be doing more to put habitat wherever we can, you know, add that? So those are the kinds of things that I don't think would come to mind without interagency dialogue. So I'm glad your group is bringing those perspectives forward. And please prompt us if there are things we as an agency aren't automatically thinking about, because we'll look at it further.
Mr. Chair.
John, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I was just going to get to the citizen members and making sure that the two of you who are representing the citizens here today didn't feel excluded.
Thank you.
I want you to also feel free to hop in here.
Thank you. Tina, just an informational question. When you talk about the I-35 corridor, what does that exactly mean? Does that mean the highway right-of-way, or does that mean a certain distance out on each side of that Highway 35 right-of-way?
Both. when we're talking with the DOTs, it's really the highway right-of-way that when we're talking about DOTs. But as an effort, as a broader effort, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has latched onto the I-35 corridor, and they're looking at like 50 miles on each side, you know, really making it an effort to really focus on, you know, that 50-mile range, or, you know, on each side, so 100-mile swath around I-35 to really hit on a whole bunch of stuff. So the amount I mentioned, the 175,000 acres that MnDOT owns as green space, you throw in township and county roads, and that almost quadruples. I mean, it's amazing the amount of county and township, you know. And Commissioner Landwehr talks about the state managed lands that are out there. What about the county parks? What about the tax forfeit? It's, you know, so once you start looking at that, it's really more of a big picture. It's not just rights of way. It's really beyond that. How can we be impacting positively the pollinator habitat that's out there? And Department of Transportation has specifications and guidelines that a lot of counties, highway departments latch onto. So if we can provide guidance on how to do this along rights of way, you know, that could easily be translated to a county road or a township road. It could be taken, you know, with utility rights of way as well. So and same thing with Department of Natural Resources. You know, they've got guidance on their parks and their SNAs that could be taken to county parks, that could be taken to city parks and that kind of thing. So it's really, it depends on who you talk to as far as where that corridor is. The DOTs are focusing on the I-35 rights of way. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is focusing on a 100-mile swath.
Tom?
Mr. Chair, while we're on the topic, if I could just digress a little bit, you know, we're talking about both monarchs and pollinators, and that, you know, one of the things we have to keep in mind, especially in Minnesota, is that while we do have monarchs migrating through from Canada to Mexico, we also produce monarchs here, right? We are breeding, grounds as well as our migration grounds, and so as we think about a migration corridor, that's really beneficial. But we have to think larger picture because we are producing those butterflies here that then ultimately migrate. Different situation with most pollinators. Most pollinators are not migratory. They just live and born in one section, you know. So, again, it goes back to that notion we have to have a dispersed, distributed network of habitats as well as these migration corridors that help, you know, for the whole life cycle needs of some of these critters. Mm-hmm.
And as a part of the seed mixes that we have out there, the 33 seed mixes that are out there, we also have four species of milkweed, which is essential to the development of the monarchs. We do have that included into our seed mixes, so we've covered as the caterpillar part of it. Now we need the nectar producing nectar and pollen sources out there for them to migrate down.
Matt? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tina, I was actually just going to return to the seed mixes. I'm curious, are the seed mixes, are they purchased from a vendor, or are they seed mixes that you put together at DOT specially?
They're purchased from a vendor. So having the state-listed seed mixes out there, the vendors know what we expect. And it's actually called the yellow tag in MnDOT, and that makes sure that there's enough pure live seed per species and that it's mixed properly within each bag that's ordered.
And the reason I ask, and maybe this is already the case, but otherwise we could help make sure that those seed mixes vis-a-vis the significant land holdings of local governments and local park chains, if that's on a state contract such that it's on a cooperative purchasing venture contract. We oftentimes have local governments do a lot of their purchasing directly off state contracts, so we could make sure that those mixes are on a state contract such that it smooths the pathway for them to buy the same thing.
I'll have to get back to you on that one. I'm not the expert in our area on seed mixes, so I don't believe right now that the seed mixes are on a contract, but I don't know if that's been examined or not.
Okay.
Other questions or comments for Ms. Markinson? If not, Tina, thank you very much for a really informative discussion.
Thank you.
Great questions for discussion also. All right, we've been joined by Commissioner Rothman. Commissioner Rothman, thank you.
Yeah, good to be here.
Let's move then to item number 6 on the agenda, and that will be the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team. Next steps and update. Welcome, Paul Moss. Good to see you all.
And Mr. Chairman here, before Paul gets going, a little bit of extra context, too. We've been, over the last couple of months, trying to explore a more collaborative relationship with the ICAT team, really in an effort to do a couple of things. One is to elevate the issue of adaptation a little bit more, but also to try and better weave it into the conversations we have at the board here on mitigation quite frequently. And so and Paul has been an instrumental part in trying to help us organize the COP21 meetings that have happened over the last couple of months. And so I just wanted to kind of note that because we're trying to establish a little bit more of a regular check-in for the ICAT team to update the board on progress on some of these critical issues.
Are all presenters here today? Anna Henderson is not, I don't believe she, but Anna Dirkswager is here, I see, and Laura, Lisa, and Megan, are they here? Maybe just we could bring some chairs and you could all come on up at the same time if you wish.
Sure.
Rather than putting you all individually on the spot, this is more comfortable. One more chair. There it comes. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
If the lights are off, it's on.
Okay, thank you.
Makes total sense, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and to present on an update on what's going on with climate adaptation in Minnesota and what our interagency climate adaptation team has been working on. We were pleased to present to the board back in November 2013, and so it's great to have an opportunity to update again. Just looking ahead at the agenda here, see if I get this right. We'll get this in a sec. Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you. So there's going to be four parts of the next 90 minutes, approximately. First is to go through an overview and discussion of climate adaptation in general and our team's work, then talk about some new climate adaptation statewide indicators that we've been working on. Then there'll be four agency presentations from the fellow staff members sitting here from the DNR and PCA, Met Council, and Bowser. And then we really want to engage the board in a discussion on next steps and what are some opportunities moving forward. So adaptation and mitigation, and just a very brief review, adaptation is basically referring to looking at these trends that we're seeing, looking at these climate impacts that are either being observed now or projected. What are we doing to address them? It often has to do with risk management, protecting our infrastructure, and typically the responses are on the local level. On the contrast, climate mitigation talks about reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, which is of critical importance. But it involves looking at our global economic and energy systems, and typically we're going to need a global response. Interestingly, there is an intersection between adaptation and mitigation in terms of certain types of activities, and such as urban trees or water conservation or certain green building practices. And so there definitely are some activities that achieve both of those goals. Summarizing in a couple slides, what are some of the climate impacts we're seeing? I know this will not be news to most of you, but we're seeing increasing temperatures in Minnesota. This chart here represents actually some projections looking forward from the National Climate Assessment, which was done by the federal government in 2014. It's going to be too hard to read from where you're sitting, but essentially we're going to be seeing higher average temperatures, more days over 95 degrees, longer frost-free season, and more cooling degree days looking forward into the mid-century as compared with 1971 to 2000. The other main impact we're going to be seeing is changes in precipitation. We're going to be expecting to see and have been seeing greater average precipitation. We've seen more heavy precipitation. This chart just indicates that we're seeing more very heavy precipitation events, increased flood magnitude, and also changes in precipitation patterns. And then in terms of some of the seasonality effects, our growing seasons are getting longer. These are already observed comparing 1991 to 2012 compared to 1901 to 1960. We're seeing that our growing season is nine days longer, and that has an impact on vector-borne diseases, pests, and longer allergy season, as well as a positive impact on growing crops. So how does this translate into some of what we've been seeing in Minnesota recently? You know, some of the extreme precipitation events have been causing damage to our infrastructure and our natural resources, as well as heat has been causing damage to our vital fisheries. Wildfire, windstorms, dry periods, all of these have been having impacts in Minnesota that we've already seen. So it's a significant issue, we as the state agencies have been working to address this. So starting in 2009, a number of agencies came together voluntarily. It was initiated by the agencies to create this interagency climate adaptation team. It was in part started in response to some of the flooding that happened in southeast Minnesota in the mid-2000s, and also in recognition that some of the agencies were already starting in, on their own to do some climate adaptation work and that they could benefit from collaboration. So the key members that are involved with the effort, and there are other agencies involved as well, but Agriculture, Bowser, Commerce, Health, Met Council, Natural Resources, MPCA, Department of Public Safety, and MnDOT. So what's our vision? We came together as a group, and we have a vision of a resilient, economically thriving, and healthy Minnesota that's prepared for both long and short-term climate changes and weather extremes. On fleshing out that vision, we created a 2013 report, Adapting to Climate Change in Minnesota. We put in your packet prior to this meeting some of the opportunities that were identified as part of that report, if you want to look at them. And the report itself is available online. Anyway, this was something that is, even though it's a couple years old, it's still timely and has for describing the climate impacts for the state of Minnesota as well as identifying opportunities for interagency collaboration. We still feel that it's a relevant and helpful document moving forward. We've made presentations to the legislature and EQB, as I've mentioned, and currently work to collaborate on a number of joint proposals, identifying opportunities, as well as sharing information and networking between the agencies. So how is Minnesota doing? We just happened to see that in November 2015, there was a report card that rated all the states in the country on their climate preparedness. It was prepared by the nonprofit Climate Central, which is a neutral source, working with ICF International, which is a large Washington, D.C. Beltway consulting company. Anyway, they gave Minnesota a B-minus relative to our climate threats and other states' efforts. And I just want to run through a little bit about that. I put the actual report card in your packet, so you can take a look at the details of that if you're interested. Some of the strengths and weaknesses that were identified with particular focus on heat and drought were the report that our team did, the fact that climate adaptation is integrated into the State Hazard Mitigation Plan, which is prepared by the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management from the Department of Public Safety. The great work that the Minnesota Department of Health has done through their Climate and Health Program, a number of really fantastic documents there, as well as other efforts. In terms of opportunities or potential weaknesses, the report card suggested that we might want to take advantage of doing additional sector-based vulnerability assessments. I believe the board has heard from the Minnesota Department of Health about the excellent sector-based vulnerability assessment they've done from the health perspective. But there's other sectors as well that do not have sector-based vulnerability assessments, including energy, water, communities. Transportation has done with funding from the federal government, from the Federal Highway Administration, has done vulnerability assessment in two regions, but there's opportunity to do additional transportation vulnerability assessments beyond the state highway system as well. Another thing that was identified as an opportunity area or potential gap was that Minnesota does not have a statewide climate adaptation plan. They also felt that we could take more steps to better increase tracking of climate change impacts, and that we could also make better use of guidelines, requirements, and policies to support resilient activities such as might be involved with construction or building. So another way of comparing Minnesota to other states is this chart, which is from the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. And you can see the states on the coast, they have produced adaptation plans. There's 15 states that actually have climate adaptation plans. Wisconsin has a plan in the center of the country, but pretty much every other state that has a plan are those on the coast. We're noted in green as having an adaptation plan in progress, and that's based on some of the work that we've done with the interagency team. And then there's other states such as Utah, Colorado, and Arizona that have adaptation components in a broader climate change plan for their state. So providing a little bit of national and international context, there have been a number of federal executive orders on climate adaptation in the last few years. It's been a priority for the president, and all federal agencies were required to prepare their own climate adaptation plans. By 2014, they're all posted online, and they make interesting reading with some of the departments, you know, of transportation or Homeland Security or EPA, all have various plans on available for the public to see. As been mentioned, there was recently the climate talks in Paris, and part of what was in the final agreement was a number of different sections that relate to climate adaptation. So I think we're going to be seeing on an international level more focus on climate adaptation as well. There aren't any international targets on climate adaptation, but it's something that's to be integrated into each country's climate change activities. And then there are also a number of voluntary agreements, and I'm going to talk about one of these. There's the Under 2 MOU, Regions Adapt, and the 4 per 1,000 initiative. Under 2 MOU, I'll mention more detail because our governor and lieutenant governor have signed that in October. But the Regions Adapt is another collaborative effort between subnational bodies, states, or cities to work together to advance climate adaptation. The 4 per 1,000 initiative has to do with specifically having more carbon preserved in soil in. And so it's a kind of a more agricultural-oriented initiative that was started by the government of France. But all three of these initiatives were connected with the climate talks in Paris and were ways that non-nations would be able to participate. So under 2 MOU, a copy is in your packet. I believe that most or all of you are familiar with that. But it started between a collaboration between California and one of the German states. And it included commitments by these subnational governments in advance of Paris. It's now been signed by 123 jurisdictions representing more than 700 million people, including the following United States states, California, Connecticut, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington, as well as several cities. So Minnesota is definitely among the leaders nationally and internationally for having signed this. One of the interesting things about it is that in addition to the MOU setting goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it also has a specific Section 3, which advances adaptation and resilience. And that focuses a lot on collaboration, measurement, and best practices. So what are we doing in Minnesota to assess our progress on our own? I've talked about what's happening outside the state, but there is quite a bit of adaptation work going on at a number of agencies. The question is, how is this helping us to achieve our overall statewide climate adaptation objectives? So as a result of trying to answer that question, ICAD is now working to develop a set of statewide indicators of climate adaptation. And these indicators are going to be useful both in terms of helping to inform the way that our limited resources are distributed, but it also we're hoping that indicators can help to catalyze attention and progress on advancing climate adaptation. So I'll go through the different indicators right now that were selected. And I'll explain the process through which we came up with them. We used I'm sure many of you are familiar with results-based accountability. It's an important tool that's been used by the administration to set government priorities and to evaluate programs. It's a useful approach that looks at the difference that we want to make, which in our case is our vision statement about being prepared for being resilient to increasing climate impacts. And then it identifies measures to help assess progress towards the goal. So we worked with Judy Plant from MMB to hold a half-day workshop on RBA in September 2015, held a number of follow-up meetings and discussion, and came up with, through a consensus process, five statewide indicators of adaptation. And the goal is that we would like to, we're planning on having initial data for all of these indicators by August 2016. These are the indicators that we came up with. Climate adaptation planning by state agencies, local units of government, and tribal governments. Disruptions to the power grid. Hospital data for heat-related health impacts. Inflation-adjusted damages from extreme weather. And canopy cover for urban and community forests. And the idea is that by gathering data to support these indicators, we're going to both be able to evaluate our progress in these areas which relate to climate adaptation directly or indirectly, and also hopefully to catalyze some additional action in these areas. So I'm going to go through each of these individually right now. There's a lead agency for each one of these indicators, and a data collection strategy has been identified and a purpose. So looking at the first one having to do with climate adaptation planning, the purpose of this is twofold. One is to measure the degree to which communities or state agencies or tribal governments are preparing standalone climate adaptation plans. There are a few that have been doing this, not a lot, but we want to inventory and establish who they are in a more coordinated way, and also to measure the degree to which climate adaptation is being integrated into ongoing planning efforts on a number of different parameters. You've heard today about water planning and some of the issues with water planning with that Bowser is doing. So there's opportunities for integrating climate adaptation into water planning. There's land use planning, solid waste planning, all kinds of, you know, economic development planning. All types of plans are going on throughout the state, both in agencies and local governments. And our intent is to use an online survey to survey local units of government, tribal entities, and also state agencies to get a better sense for the degree to which they're integrating climate adaptation into their planning work. Power grid disruptions, it's essentially a proxy measure, an indirect measure of preparedness or resilience to extreme weather and other climate impacts. We can assume that if the power is going down a lot and it's associated in many cases with extreme weather events, that that might reflect that we could potentially be more prepared and perhaps take some actions, additional actions that would help to prevent power outages. So our proposal is to use existing data sources, such as from Homeland Security Emergency Management, Minnesota Department of Commerce, Federal Department of Energy, and to assess this on a regular basis and to track it. The lead agency is to be determined, and we're working to do that right now. Hospital heat-related impacts, data is already being collected on this through the Minnesota Department of Health's Environmental Public Health Tracking Program, and I'll show you on the next slide a nice graph which shows some information that's already available. Again, this is an indirect measure of preparedness or resilience for extreme heat on human health, and Minnesota Department of Health is the lead agency for this. So this slide is showing the amount of how temperature is connected to rate of emergency department visits. And you can see that when there's higher temperature in the summer, in those years, you're seeing more admissions to hospitals. Now, there's a lot of issues with the data, and there's always a risk of oversimplifying. You know, there's a lot of complexity to the way that data is coded in emergency departments, there's other issues that if you want to know more detail about it, we have staff here from the Minnesota Department of Health that can address those questions. But in any case, we felt that of the options available, this would be a helpful indicator that would give some window into the heat impact on our population and could reflect to some extent, the degree of preparedness and climate adaptation. Damage from extreme weather is another measure, and that has to do with you know, damage to property from these extreme weather events. There's a lot of data available from Homeland Security Emergency Management and FEMA that we can use, and Homeland Security Emergency Management would be the lead agency for this. And then finally, the urban forest canopy cover. As urban trees are one of the greatest tools for climate adaptation, and because they can not only help to address extreme heat, they can help also to intercept heavy precipitation events. They can improve water quality. They have many other benefits. They can help with energy conservation. Anyway, they have both climate adaptation and climate mitigation benefits, but we felt that in terms of looking at the degree to which communities are utilizing green infrastructure practices, this would be a good thing that we could use. And it is something that is being measured by the DNR and others. So the DNR would be the lead agency for this. At this point, I would like to turn the presentation over to our four presenters. First one will be from the Minnesota DNR, Anna Dirkswager, who will be talking about some innovative work that the department is doing in climate adaptation.
Welcome, Anna.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay if I just speak like this?
You better stretch.
All right, we'll stretch. It'll
work. You got plenty of cord here, so.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Keep going.
Okay, good. Are you going to flip for me, Paul?
Yeah. Why don't I hand this to you?
Wonderful. Thanks.
Anna, why don't you pull that a little closer? That way the people that are viewing
way
from...
back.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, okay.
Can hear you.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for having us here today. I am going to talk to you all about the DNR's operational order on climate change. We are an agency that has been leading on climate change, and so we thought it might be of interest to sort of illustrate for you all what we have done to, or what we are doing to address climate change, in the case that you're looking for a model to replicate or ideas for how you might go forward yourselves. So today I'm going to talk about what is an operational order at the DNR, what does this op order do from an agency in a statewide perspective, and what are the benefits of this policy tool. Okay, so an op order for the DNR, an operational order for us is a directive to staff on how to carry out their work or something that they need to be mindful of in the course of carrying out their day-to-day work. We have op orders on a host of topics. We have op orders on everything from how you order your uniform all the way to how you deal with invasive species. So an op order on climate change is kind of a big thing to put together, a big challenge to address, but we think it was an appropriate way to tackle the issue at hand. So what does this op order do for us from an agency and statewide perspective? Basically, it's directing staff to enhance ecosystems' ability to respond and adapt or reduce the negative impacts from climate change. That's a tall order. Within 1 year of this op order, the divisions, so we have six land management divisions. These divisions need to figure out a way to comply with this overarching op order. And they're going to do that basically by developing, each division will develop guidance that addresses how they will go about that work within that division. So there's flexibility built into the op order that allows a division like Fish and Wildlife to think about how they will address climate change differently than, say, how forestry would address climate change. Broadly put, the op order has two big parts. There's an adaptation component and there's a mitigation component. I'm not going to walk through the difference in that. Paul just did that for you a second ago. But basically, that's the way we're going about this. A big directive to think about climate change and figure out how you're going to incorporate ways to adapt or reduce negative impacts in your day-to-day work, and that will be unique to the work that you do within your own division. So that's the big picture. I'm going to talk a little bit just briefly about why we think this is a good tool and why it's working for us. There's a great deal of flexibility in the way we've put this op order together. So this is important because not only does that flexibility reflect the inherent variability in different division work, but it allows us the ability to address to different threats of climate change that are going to happen over time. So where we're starting today, you know, hopefully will not be the same approach we're using a year, 10 years from now. And so there's flexibility built into that. it's also important because having this op order put together and standing behind it and having it down in writing gives employees some leverage to think about climate change. And that's not to say we haven't encouraged thinking about climate change, but it definitely makes it more of a topic that's front and center. So if you are perhaps interested in a creative approach to thinking about, okay, well, what tree species is going to better grow here than I've thought about planting traditionally, there's something to stand behind that thought for you in proposing maybe a new way to address the situation, and that's important. And the third big thing, in order to be effective, you need to have some teeth in what you're proposing, right? So this op order has an accountability standard built into it. So a year from its inception, each division is held to a scorecard. That scorecard is being developed with input from all of the individual divisions. So it's something that's agreed upon by those who will be monitored, and then they'll be held to that standard. So that's really it. I'm not going to go into great detail because there's a lot of us. But I guess the other big thing that I want to mention, kind of like Paris, too, I think the big thing for DNR is to recognize that success begets success. So it's not perfect. It's not going to fix everything that we're dealing with right now, but you've got to start somewhere. And that's what we're doing.
Thanks, Anna. Questions for Anna, or shall we maybe just hold until we're through with the entire proposal? Just want to go down the list. So, Laura? Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
Laura's representative from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And I'll be talking briefly now about how we are assisting Minnesota cities with climate adaptation and community resilience. So the Minnesota Green Step Cities Program, in case you're not familiar with it, is a public-private partnership that probably involves all the state agencies represented here, as well as others, with at least some staff that are providing best practice advisor assistance to communities, have helped to create the best practice actions, or are very actively involved on the steering committee. It's really important because cities are a really important front line for state policy implementation. As your commissioner updates, explained, a lot of the topics that are coming up are things that cities are dealing with actively, and they also relate directly to the kind of climate adaptation indicators that Paul was talking about. So the challenge is huge for cities, and municipal resources really are insufficient to the task of the kind of infrastructure needs that there are, as well as community building needs. And so state assistance programs are really important. State bond funding is really important. The best practices can really help cities focus limited resources and even to look at some possibilities for private support, as was being talked about with getting private foundations helping with pollinator issues. It's the same kind of thing that we really need to all work on this together. So Minnesota Green Step Cities has a very broad uptake. There are 91 cities in it now and growing, and in fact, 17 of those cities are new in 2015, which was like a 23% increase in the total. And so they're being recruited all the time and really seeing the value in this program. So it's a challenge assistance and recognition program. It's online. It's available to everyone to be able to go in, see all the best practices, all the implementation tools and resources. But member cities actually go to their city council, have them pass a resolution that they want to participate, and then they're given a login ability to actually share their activities online, which everybody else can see too, how they're implementing things, to find out who's working on it in a different city and be able to call them and get advice. So it's a great tool. It covers cities with more than 35% of Minnesota's population, all stripes, all locations, urban, rural, suburban, and you can see from the map the broad coverage that we have. So this climate adaptation best practice is best practice 29 added to the 28 original, which are all focused on sustainability. As Paul mentioned, adaptation and resilience really complements sustainability, really overlaps with it to a great extent, but there's also this additional area of trying to deal with risk to and prepare for it, reduce the risk, and then figure out how to set things up to be able to recover much more quickly and to have communities that just are stronger and more socially connected to support each other in doing that. Because social connectedness has been proven through Hurricane Sandy and other things to really make a difference in how quickly communities recover. And so this best practice covers a very broad array of topics of interest, I think, to all of you. And the way the best practice works, a best practice is a very broad concept. So here it's plan and prepare for extreme weather, adapt to changing climatic conditions, foster stronger community connectedness and social and economic vitality. Then that best practice is broken up into different actions, from 4 to 8 actions. So each of the 29 has 4 to 8 actions, and each of those actions has 3 different star levels of implementation action. So really there's a very broad array of things for people to do under each of them. And I'll go quickly through what they are for this best practice. So under the topic of leadership and strategy, it really talks about integrating into planning and budgetary processes. A very key piece, hazard mitigation planning, all the areas that Paul was talking about for the state level need to happen at cities too, whether it's vulnerability assessment, comprehensive planning, capital budget planning. So a really key takeaway is how important facilitating planning is. Resiliency, more than anything, requires advance preparation. And then in the health, and that's the first action under the best practice. The second action is in the category of health and well-being. So it's preparing to maintain public health and safety and taking a preventive approach. This is working with vulnerable populations. It could be something like designating community safe shelter for extreme heat events or extreme precipitation events, and providing outreach and incentives for private property reduction. So really we're talking about not just cities and their public property and infrastructure, but a community can't be resilient unless all the people's places of home and work are also more resilient. And then the third and fourth actions under this best practice come under the economy and society category, which is really reaching out to economically vulnerable residents to build their prosperity in an equitable manner and help build social connectedness, whether it's through, you know, parks, public spaces, all kinds of activities, a shared understanding of their commitment to the community. And really, again, here it's that it's so important to have more equitable economic development and development that really strengthens community resilience to be taking all this into account as we develop properties and retrofit properties. And then under the fifth and sixth actions that are focused on infrastructure and environment, that's where we get into protecting public and critical infrastructure and facilities, and then also reducing the urban heat island effect. So that could be everything from the work that's done on roads and their impact on urban heat island. It's protecting buildings and infrastructure from flash flooding and other extreme weather, trying to, again, incentivize more protection and private properties, and also working on urban heat island, a lot of it through infrastructure, both what we would call hard and soft. So it could be cool roofs, it could be a lot of urban trees and stormwater infrastructure, all of which contributes to a reduction in urban heat island impact. And another part of this that didn't get included but is in the best practice action is also distributed renewable energy systems and microgrids, and promoting those through the work that the city could do on their local systems. And then finally, the last action, action 7, draws back into sustainable best practices that are really investment focused, that are part of the rest of Green Step Cities, and it's to make long-term investments and really realize the importance of doing that for resilience. So whether it's energy savings, air quality, infrastructure, water conservation, complete streets, it ties back to specific best practices that call for investment and retrofit, and which are not getting that much traction right now because they cost more money and take more planning, but are crucial. So anyway, that's just that front-end investments are really important for the resilience future. So with that, that's my contact information, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Laura. Let's go then to Lisa Barras. Welcome, Lisa. Lisa's here from the Met Council.
Thank you. I'm Lisa Barajas, and I'm talking to you today about the council's approach to climate adaptation in the region. Just for some context, we don't cover the whole state, just the seven-county region, but it is more than half of the state's population that lives in our seven counties and is quite an economic engine for our state as well. So impacts to our region have a great impact to our state, but we also feel things acutely within our region as well. So the council is responsible for guiding the orderly and economical development of the region, and part of that responsibility is developing Thrive MSP 2040, our 25-year regional plan that goes out to the year 2040 now, which then provides direction to our local units of government on how to update their plans in response to our regional plan. Our local governments are now getting underway with their local comprehensive planning process, so as the time is ripe to get into some of the pieces that Laura was talking about, planning for climate and getting us there today instead of 10 years from now. In the development of Thrive, we dug into this quite a bit, and finding that through the work through ICAD and the state and others, that especially in Minnesota, the built environment is a primary contributor to climate change. That's through energy use in our buildings and our travel and transportation patterns. How we build our communities impacts how much energy we use and how much we pollute our air, how much our carbon emissions we're putting into our atmosphere. And we're already experiencing climate change impacts in our region, to which we do need to adapt. Just in our region alone, we have a number of vulnerabilities that are just in the last 10 years or 15 years, whether it's extreme flash flooding events on Highway 169 during rush hour that can have not only just impacts to the people on the roadway, but economic impacts in our region, people getting to and from work, goods moving through and around the region. Major highways are critical for freight movement within our region and not just employees. But also extreme heat events and the unpredictable nature of things like tornadoes that can have significant impact in our neighborhoods. Those are the climate-related impacts, but we're also looking at how does this impact our communities, our people. We expect that by 2040 we'll be 40% people of color, that one in five of our residents will be over the age of 65. We have growing racial disparities within our region. And our impacts to extreme weather events have been shown through this 267% increase in homeowner insurance rates just from 1997 to 2010 that is entirely related to extreme weather events. All of these pieces, plus the fact that we do know that age, folks who are economically vulnerable, and people of color, all of these additional features tend to exacerbate the impacts of climate change, and those are the folks that are impacted the most in these pieces. So it really drove us to then look at what are we going to do in our region. The council adopted an outcome-based approach in Thrive MSP 2040 with five of those main outcomes interrelated, not freestanding, but stewardship, prosperity, equity, livability, and sustainability. And within sustainability, very specifically tying in the integration of climate mitigation, adaptation and resilience into our own management of our regional infrastructure systems, but also our local support, or the support that we give to local governments in their planning and implementation. It is all connected. We can't build purely regional systems and expect it to work for everybody, but local governments and their implementation of local road networks, surface water management efforts, all of those pieces need to work together. And as Laura had mentioned earlier, a lot of this is it's a big burden for local governments who may not have the burden or have the funding that they need to get things done. Digging a little deeper into Thrive, we also provide that land use guidance for our communities. And one of our policies, out of our six policies, is to promote sensitive land use and development patterns that contribute toward achieving our state's adopted greenhouse gas emission goals at the regional scale, but also then to develop that local resilience to the impacts of climate change. We are very specifically working on a number of items that provide that local assistance to governments, but also I just want to touch on some things. There are a lot of things that we're doing in our own operations that are more about mitigation, but also risk management for our infrastructure. But on the adaptation side, a lot of that is working toward to providing the resources we can for our local governments as they get started on their comprehensive planning process now that's expected to go through the end of 2018 when their plans are due to be submitted to the Metropolitan Council for review and authorization. So just some of those items, broadly technical assistance to local governments, partnering with folks like Laura and Paul around Green Stuff Cities and getting those pieces where communities are already started and ready to go and providing that support, shining the light on the work that they are doing, helping other communities who haven't thought about it yet, but get them on the fence or maybe on the fence thinking about what can we do and don't know where to start, helping them to move along in that direction and seeing what else we can provide to help them in their efforts. One of the pieces that we will be getting started on this year is a climate vulnerability assessment for the region regarding the built environment, starting first with our own regional systems, our own investments, and looking at specifically the geography of vulnerability related to water today, flooding risk today, but also projected into the future. When we know that the frequency of flooding events is no longer a 1% chance of a 100-year event, those are much more frequent than normal. But when can we, we're going to start looking at projecting at how frequently can we expect to see these types of events, a 100-year event, a 500-year event, and what does that geography look like? And then what does that geography mean for our transportation system? What does it mean for our transit system? What does it mean for our wastewater system? What does it mean for our local roads networks? And then, so looking at what it means for our regional systems, but then sharing that information with our local governments on this is what we know it means for us. What do you think it means for your work in planning for your local infrastructure investments moving forward? But we won't limit it just to infrastructure. A second phase will be then looking at what does this mean for the people in your community? Who is now being cut off by some of these pieces that you hadn't considered before? Water being one of them, but we also want to dig into extreme heat and where that might be concentrated. These are all related to one another, too. So stormwater reuse and water efficiency grants are some of the things that we've already started rolling out in 2015 and will continue to do in 2016. We are also developing an urban forestry program for the region. There's been a number of short-term funded projects that we want to coordinate into a regional program, starting with just baseline canopy assessment and then that analysis related to our climate vulnerability of how can we prioritize our resources where they're going to have the greatest impact, but then monitor and evaluate, are we having the impact that we expect to have in these areas by having a solid funding source to continue to keep looking back at these things going forward. And finally, something that many of you probably know that we go back to every year for is our inflow and infiltration program on our wastewater system and the local wastewater system. That program really is about funding to reduce clear water inflow into the wastewater system. So we're reducing the need for infrastructure, for wastewater infrastructure in our region by taking out water we don't need to treat, preventing it from even getting into the system by fixing our pipes. Some of our pipes are very old, over 100 years old, and are in need of repair. But it's not just public, it's also private. So those are lands, are a program that we continue to push for regular funding on a regular basis. It doesn't not only make it better for reserving our preserving our regional system, but also helps prevent us having overflows during major storm events at our wastewater treatment facilities. And no one wants a sewage overflow into our rivers. So it helps protect our water quality as well. That's all I have for you today, but I'd be happy to answer questions later.
Thank you very much, Lisa. And now let's please go to Megan from
Hello.
The Board of Water and Soil Resources. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Megan Lennon. I'm a soil scientist at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I'm going to give you a really quick overview today of two Bowser programs whose they help landowners manage their land that in ways that have climate adaptation benefits, and they provide those climate adaptation benefits by increasing perennial vegetation on the landscape as well as living cover. So just to set the stage, I want to really show you a series of satellite images to kind of get you all to understand how much vegetative cover there is on the landscape, living cover, or how much we don't have on the landscape. So I want you to find Minnesota on the map and I want you to focus on the brown colors. So the brown color, that's bare soil. And then focus on when the dark green colors come in. So the dark green colors would represent our row crops like corn, bean, sugar beets. And when it turns fully green in Minnesota, that means that our soil is has a full canopy cover. So we're starting out in April. We have a lot of bare soil out there, and even in May also. Into June, we're starting to get some soil cover from those crop canopies, but it really isn't until July that we have full canopy cover on our soil. And then fast forward to October around harvest time, again, there isn't any living cover on much of the agricultural portion of the state. So really what I want you to take away from this is that there's on a good year, an average year, there's about 3 months where we have full vegetative cover in the agricultural portions of the state. And just recognizing that this is a vulnerable system, having soil that is bare for so long. And one way that we can address these vulnerabilities is to try to find ways to put perennial plants into the agricultural landscape where it makes sense, and then also try to put in living cover like cover crops, again, where that makes sense. So a little context. Now I'm just going to give you a quick flyover of two Bowser programs. The first one I want to talk about is CREP. That's the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. And this is a federal-state partnership, and it is focusing on putting 100,000 acres into permanent conservation easements. So the practices that would be implemented on the land as a part of CREP would be floodplain, wetland restoration, prairie pothole restoration, wide grass filter strips, like on the magnitude of like hundreds of feet rather than a few feet or 50 feet in width, as well as putting perennial vegetation in wellhead protection areas. And this program focuses on riparian lands and marginal or environmentally sensitive agricultural lands. And CREP, we anticipate there to be a sign-up beginning this summer. The current status is that the governor has sent the official proposal to D.C., and we're waiting for paperwork to be signed, but we anticipate that this will be up and rolling this summer. The next program I want to talk about, and we all know about the buffer program, but I want to talk about this in a little bit different context, in the context of a co-benefit of climate adaptation. So just really briefly, this program has an estimated impact of about 110,000 acres, and it requires 50-foot buffers on public waters and a one-rod buffer on public ditches. But the interesting part of this program is that in law there is a provision that allows for landowners to have a reduced buffer width if they put alternative practices in upslope or in adjacent fields. So at Bowser, we think there's a lot of opportunity to put additional practices, best management practices with living cover on the landscape as a part of this program if landowners choose to do so. And I'll just give some quick examples. So here we have a terrace that is made up of perennial grasses. It has lots of benefits, like erosion benefits, but also some climate adaptation benefits in terms of slowing the water moving off a field. Here is a grass waterway. Again, this is composed of perennial grasses. And then this last example is cover crops. This is an annual rye crop, and it's shown in a corn field. So all of these alternative practices have many benefits. Some would be a soil health, water quality, and then also climate adaptation. And we think that when we put practices on the landscape, we're really maximizing those benefits. So all the BMPs that would be put in place as a part of CREP or the buffer program have a wide variety of benefits. So I'm not going to go through them one by one. I have some listed up here. But really what I want to emphasize is that the CREP, the buffer program, and other Bowser programs really contribute to the creation of resilient landscapes by increasing the water storage capacity on the landscape, reducing peak flows in streams and rivers, and mitigating flood impacts, just as a few examples. So I realize that was a really quick flyover of some Bowser programs, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our astute panelists today? Mr. Rothman.
This isn't really a question. I just want to start off with a few comments and then pose some challenges to all of us. First of all, I want to applaud all of you for the work that you've done. When we started the EQB in 2011, many of us around the table were looking at climate change issues, mitigation, and adaptation, and identified adaptation as a significant one to move forward. So the work since then, including the report in 2013, the work that you've done interagency-wise and then individually in each of our agencies is something to be applauded and necessary. And, you know, that's the first place to start. So congratulations. Our work is not done. We won't be, because it's going to continue to be a significant issue. Despite the fact we might want to wish it away, it's not going to go away. It's going to get ever more difficult as we go forward. Second of all, I want to go back to a few things, Paul, you had pointed out. I do want to focus in on the under 2 MOU. Germany approached the state, approached the Department of Commerce, me, and all to facilitate the signing of it. With PCA's help, we presented to the governor and to the lieutenant governor, and both embraced it. We've signed it. And in addition to the mitigation, there are the adaptation measures. And I would use this as a focal point to harness and to say there is a directive, in a way, embedded in the agreement to participate not just within ourselves and our agencies, but then to take the best from COP21 and other countries. Just want to also echo some of the voices of the young people we heard at the Paris debriefing. And some of the younger folks came back, and their focus, not just on climate mitigation, is adaptation. And if you think about the vulnerable populations, vulnerable people that are, we all are vulnerable to what will happen, but there are vulnerable populations, and their hearts are in this, and it's not just in all the aspects of reducing greenhouse gas, but also to protect people, to protect our communities, and to do that hard work, and to do the things that you're doing in the programs and finding ways to find funds and resources to do the adaptations that's necessary is imperative. It's without doubt imperative. The other thing I'd like to point out, and it was sort of touched on in one of the slides, was this insurance impact. We saw it. We were on the tours with the governor, for example, when we were up in Duluth, the tornado impacts and some of the things that are out there. What we should be, let me just put it this way. I want to highlight it. We talk about hurricanes as being, or thinking that those are catastrophic events, and they are significant in the United States. And you can see that in one of the slides, it showed that there's going to be increased precipitation along the coast, decreased in California and other areas. But in the data, the actual financial information about the impact, Minnesota is one of the biggest states impacted by catastrophic events compared to the coasts. And a large part of that is due to the fact that we get these storms that come through and blow through here. We get hail and crop damage that is immense. And we saw the tornado impact. We saw the flooding in Duluth and Red River Valley. We have already started climate adaptation in some areas. People are moving away from water as fast as they can in some areas. But we have a lot of issues. So I just wanted to point that out, too, in terms of the impact and the financial stakes, the financial stake that is that's important and on our minds in order to solve and adapt. With the department, at the Department of Commerce, and what we're doing on the energy side to mitigate, you know, greenhouse gases, that goes without question, that we're doing everything we can. But then on the adaptation side, and I saw that Commissioner Mossman has left at this point, I wanted to at least applaud some of the work that he's doing with our agencies, too, that we're not mentioning, with changing our buildings and at the state level. all of us in a way at the table are focused on it. And then lastly, I know as I we were on a phone call earlier, Commissioner Landwehr and I with Commissioner Stein, he's traveling about as a co-chair of the Climate Change Subcommittee of the EQB, wanted to be here. I wanted to make it the importance of seeing the presentations in person myself. But I also think this and the things that you're doing are important milestones. So as you proceed along, it would be important for us to keep track of all these things and work with you as a group. And again, whatever resources you think you need, attention to some of these issues, please let us know. And to work collaboratively to get to good outcomes is imperative. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other comments or questions?
Mr. Chair, we have some questions that we wanted to pose to the board, if that's okay.
Sure.
These were, just so you know, this was a very collaborative process of putting together today's presenters. We talked about all the different agencies and agreed through a consensus process which four we felt would be the best for today's presentation. As you know, there's other agencies that also have work that's going on. But we came up with these questions, and in the light of what you're saying, Commissioner Rothman, you know, in terms of additional direction or resources, these are some things that we would appreciate your perspective as a group on. One is, you know, do we need more state planning for climate change adaptation? Do we need a broader examination analysis of our vulnerabilities as a state? Should our team work to develop a climate change adaptation plan for the state, which was noted as a deficit in our report card? And how could our agencies better assist local governments with adaptation planning? So on any of these questions or additional questions, we'd appreciate your thoughts to the extent that time permits.
Well, I think the short answer is yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Any more questions?
And the long answer is yes.
Just to add on to that, I think that what we want to see is not that we're a B-minus, but that we're an A. Mm-hmm. And to do that, how do we get there? And that would be...
Tom, and then Brian.
Mr. Chairman, and specifically to the first one, I echo that. I think the answer is yes, but my mind hurts just thinking about what that looks like, because I think just a couple of presentations here, the overlap between the Bowser work, the putting grass on the landscape, as well as the stuff we talked about earlier, the pollinator habitat. I mean, there's tremendous overlap between these things. And, you know, you think of grass on a landscape, it's an adaptation strategy in that it holds water, reduces peak flows, reduces the strain on infrastructure, hard infrastructure. It protects water quality. I think of the Mississippi River as a source of water for all of us in the Twin Cities area here. It provides habitat for pollinators and so on, but it also has a mitigation strategy. Every acre of grass holds 4 tons of carbon underground, and so it actually accomplishes multiple objectives. And so we look at these programs, and I see, you know, great opportunity to align things like CREP, and I know CREP already is, with some of the sort of infrastructure desires. Let's reduce the peak flows. Let's protect the ditch system so it's there in the future. So I think there is great opportunity for additional planning, but it just blows my mind to think about. We think of these things like CREP as sort of green infrastructure. How do you measure green infrastructure with hard infrastructure, such as maximizing the value of both? But I welcome that kind of discussion. I just find it very, very challenging to think of how that happens. But I guess I'll put the last plug in. You know, as was mentioned, the CREP proposal is sitting in front of USDA right now in Washington. The governor has put, I think, $30 million into the bonding request for the state match. That would be $800 million for 100,000 acres. It is not inexpensive. It is perpetual. The state contribution on that is $150 million. So it's not inexpensive. We need to do it right. But we really have to think of grass on the ground as a climate change adaptation strategy, as well as a pollinator grass on ecosystem strategy as well.
Tom, let me just respond to that. I think I shared the same thought that a lot of stuff is going on, and I think that second point, do we need a broader examination analysis of statewide vulnerabilities? It's like examination of statewide opportunities that are already ongoing, and I think we don't really get a sense of all of the things that are going on with one group. You know, we need to take our little slice, and I think we need that broader look at what are our opportunities, what's already going on, so we can leverage each other.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Rothman, you mentioned a little while ago the flood that occurred up in Duluth not too long ago. In fact, as you recall, we had an EQB meeting in Duluth approximately a year after the flood to kind of examine some of the recovery that had taken place up there. You had mentioned during your discussion your adaptation plans are being assisted greatly with cities. And I would just reflect on something that former Mayor Ness from Duluth pointed out. He said when FEMA came in, Department of I guess it was just FEMA, not Homeland Security, but you'd mentioned both. When FEMA came in, they were willing to assist with regard to returning the infrastructure to where it was, but not to harden the infrastructure for any, you know, additional events. And there was an irony there that that the mayor pointed out that, you know, we can put it back to the way it was and it might break again, but we can't improve it over what it is. And while I agree with the consensus of the board, yes, 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 I look at the bottom one, how can the agencies better assist local governments? And maybe it's not just the agencies, maybe ICAT. Somehow we need to be able to coordinate with the federal government, with FEMA, at least to the extent that even with some local participation, we can better recover and bring our infrastructure to a more hardened state. And somehow we've got to be working with the federal government on that. So I don't know, you know, the question is not exactly worded the way I would, but, you know, how can the state coordinate better with the federal government, with FEMA, to recover from events or to help plan for future events? I just think we should take the experience, on-the-ground experience that occurred in a city in the state and say, well, they experienced it, they survived it, they got through it. Here's the advice they gave us. Let's take that to heart.
Thanks, Brian. Mike?
You know, along those lines, too, just some thoughts and suggestions, and maybe some takeaways for us to follow up on. But, you know, it talks about a state climate change adaptation plan, and presenters talked about a cities or counties, local government, and the Met Council's working on this. But we could also facilitate perhaps a best practices for all cities. I know Green Step Cities is working on it, but is there a model local government plan that we could
actually
develop?
Mike, I think there is, and I think you know, just go back to our silica sand discussion. Right. We developed a manual for local units of government, so we have some experience from an EQB perspective in putting those together, and we might just follow that same model.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. Yeah. Is to try to
a toolkit.
Yeah, a toolkit for local cities and counties, communities to take best practices, you know, and then work from there in addition to ourselves. And I wouldn't, you know, and then I agree and echo the FEMA, but I also would say that in addition to the current construction, I mean, we have the buildings in place, but we also should be thinking about new construction, working with the private sector and everything that we're doing at the state level to make sure that our buildings are, you know, well prepared.
Very good. Other comments?
I have a question for you, Paul. Could you talk a little bit more about the state of the data for the indicators in terms of, you know, when you expect to be able to have those, you know, the numbers to report on those indicators, or are there things you need to be in a position to report on them?
Well,
yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the board, at this time, our goal is to have data for each of the indicators by August the 1st. That we feel that gives us enough time to put things together. In some cases, for some of the indicators, such as the health heat indicators, that information already exists. In other cases, such as the energy indicator regarding the disruptions in the power grid, we're at a starting point in terms of learning how to proceed with that. So I think that that one perhaps poses the most challenge for us. The agencies, as part of the process of the consensus process for picking these five indicators, we tried to pick indicators that we felt there was a good possibility or a secure data source that we could tap into, so that we didn't pick an impossible task for ourselves that we wouldn't be able to use. So we tried to pick indicators that we felt were pragmatic and realistic, and it's just at this point, each of the indicators except for the energy indicator has a lead agency which is committed to providing us with that information by August.
Michelle? Paula, one thing I noticed, and you clearly, all of you were talking about storm events and flooding, inland flooding, as one of the things we really have to tackle. In the states at risk evaluation, they gave us this grade, but I noticed that inland flooding isn't even one thing they were particularly looking at. So if they added that factor in as well, I don't know if our grade would be lower in terms of our state of our planning. But I do remember going to one of the adaptation conferences, maybe it was 2 years ago, and a really sad and interesting map showing that Minnesota had both federal disaster declaration for drought and flood in the same year. Parts of the state, and how the insurance industry, of course, is looking at that and just hair on fire because of the implications for their industry. But the pace at which these issues seem to be accelerating, or at least awareness is accelerating, is, I think, causing also some angst about how we do this planning. Because just 6 or 7 years ago, when I was working at the local, at a county level, it was hard to get the county to even talk about this because it had the boogeyman climate change, you know, wording around it. Now everybody's sort of on board with the need to plan, but the idea that infrastructure for stormwater, for example, not only has to be replaced, but has to be replaced to absorb the storm events of the size that we're now seeing on a much more frequent basis, it's just very daunting in the scale of it. So all of this is really important to do. We do have to be coordinated. We do have to be efficient in where we put our resources, but we can't afford to wait any longer to really get this going because, as we can see, we're already sort of behind the curve a little bit on the evaluations of where we need to be on planning, and that didn't even take into account, you know, the fact we've got drought and flooding at the same time along with the heat.
It's a good point about the deficit of that study that gave us a B minus and that they didn't include inland flooding. They should have, because clearly that's a very major risk to our state, and I don't know if that would have increased or decreased our grade. But I agree. I think that on our team we feel that it's a really important issue that we need to move forward with planning. I think one of the challenges for us at the staff level is the resource issue, is that doing a statewide climate adaptation plan would take a lot of resources. And so I think we need direction and support from the commissioner's level and from the administration to proceed with that because, you know, it involves, you know, staff time that would be otherwise dedicated to other things. So that's just something to consider. I think that there's definitely willingness and interest in doing additional planning, but we need to have the support and resources and direction to be able to do that in the context that which would be helpful for the state.
Will, you'll take care of that then? Good point. It's all going to cost.
I think it'd be helpful, though, Paul, and this is something we can work on a little bit more, is maybe trying to refine the scope of what a plan would look like and what things it would encompass, what it wouldn't encompass, to better assess the request and share with the board.
Sharon, just a word on the last question there. I think, you know, as I think about how do we better assist local governments, I think of a couple things. One, kind of coming back to Commissioner Rothman's point about kind of rechecking in on this. We're about to embark on a huge process with over 180 some cities in the region. I think we're going to learn a lot through that process. And if there's a way to tap into Lisa and her staff's kind of expertise and what they learn along the way. And then the opposite end of the spectrum, the recipients of that assistance, having some local governments come up here, having some city planners or city staff or mayors and folks that were involved at that level give us that feedback too at some point, I think would be, we could learn a tremendous amount about that.
And we did the exact same thing with silica sand discussion here at the table. So I think that continues to indicate some kind of a model that we could use. Plus, there's many, many people, and I'm thinking that would be willing to step up and help, and I'm particularly thinking about the young people that were at the post-COP21 conference, and I recall very specifically a panel, a young boy from gentleman, 18 years old, who had traveled to Paris with his teacher, and also a young woman from St. Benedict's that was a participant, and I was struck by the passion that they brought to the discussion. But I was really impressed with this, with both of them. But at one point, a fellow in the crowd stood up and wanted to know about atomic energy, if you recall. And I thought, well, how are these young people going to answer that question? And the young fellow said, well, yes. He said, I can give you an answer. I happened to participate in a session with the Atomic Energy Commission in Paris. And he went on to give this incredible description of the discussion he had. And it was like, wow, that is, I'm really proud of this young fellow, as well as the young woman that was there also. So there's this intense passion for this segment of society, and they're from 18 to 25 years old, and they really drill down on this stuff.
Thank you.
Just a sidebar comment.
I just quickly like to comment on ask a question about the agencies assisting local governments. I'm really happy to see Lisa here, who got me through my GIS environmental planning at the Humphrey, and you made a great flash through the Florence Township's planning process for sensitive features ordinance. Really glad to see that the best of the best is it at Met Council. And I wondered from both Lisa and Laura, how much do we know about which cities and what counties, what comp plans, what sustainability departments actually have made climate change commitments in their energy planning and things? Do we have a database of that? Because I'm wondering if the climate change commitments that they've made and the adaptation strategies, if that couldn't be, you know, packaged in a way that would inform all of our efforts.
Lisa?
I can speak to a little bit about what's in the region. I'll say the plans that we have on the books right now were developed in 2005 to 2008. So there's not as much specifically around climate per se.
Okay.
There are a handful of communities who have gone the distance on that early on, the leading edge of communities on that, but really a handful. A lot of communities have incorporated just broader sustainability principles, but not necessarily climate adaptation and mitigation, greenhouse gas emissions all the way. But Laura can speak to the statewide.
Sure. Well, through Green Step Cities, similarly, this new adaptation best practice is just being unveiled this month with a workshop next month, so the cities will just be seeing it for the first time. They did have some mitigation measures that were part of the Green Step best practices, and cities that have been doing a lot have recorded it on there. So if you go to any of those best practice actions and go look at who's doing it, the tab that's who's doing it, it shows it, and certainly we could try and compile more of that information, you know, to pull it together, and that will be a good way to track things in the future.
Inspire others. And then I had one more question. I think this has more to do with DNR, and I'm just raising this in a very, very tiny way now, but it's something that really interests me. I'm wondering if in the adaptation and mitigation strategy approaches, which Will was just refreshing me about the other day, if the issue of invasive species is treated differently in those, if there's any difference in the way we look at, there is some heretical material out there, which you may or may not know about, the advances evaluating invasive species for their potential ecological benefits in rapid climate change. And I just wondered if there's anything.
So are you asking, do we treat invasive species separately under our climate change app order?
Is there any kind of different way of looking at it from an adaptation perspective or a mitigation perspective?
Yes.
Okay.
To be frank, that's not my area of expertise, but we do have an invasive species op order as well, and probably the way we mix handling invasive species in relation to climate change probably does vary by division again.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I'm certain that the two are not in completely separate silos. But to expand on that, I'd have to get back to you a little bit.
Okay, thanks. Thanks.
One more quick answer that kind of gets beyond what I was talking about with Green Step Cities, but some of the work that's being done at PCA in collaboration with other agencies and partners have been some grants that we've given out to communities and we'll be giving out in our next grant round as well for climate adaptation and planning and vulnerability assessment. So there are a number of communities that are doing work in that area now and also are doing that kind of work through our Minnesota Green Corps program where they have AmeriCorps members placed with them who are actually working on resilience and sustainability activities. And we've been running that for six, seven longer years. I've lost track even of how many, and so every year we've had, you know, projects that have been done in that area too.
Great. So. Thanks so much.
Well, Anna?
Just a quick question, follow up for you, Anna. You might have mentioned in your presentation, when was the operational order signed? So when would be a good time to check back on how it's implemented and changes that have been made?
When it was signed is fuzzy to me. I could let you know. Tom, do you recall offhand?
It was 18 months to 2 years ago.
Okay.
Thanks. Yeah, so I can tell you, Will, that by the end of, actually it was supposed to be about Christmas time, divisions are finalizing their division guidance, which is really more of the meat of what's in the op order because it's specific guidance for each division. So now that that's been coming together, the scorecard is next. So really we're looking about a year out, really from like the next month or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anna, Lisa, Laura, Megan, and Paul, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
John, please.
Paul and panel, quick question. One of your slides showed the intersection between mitigation and adaptation.
Right.
And then there was an area in there where they're together. Mm-hmm. And I'm just struggling to remember, is there equivalent to the interagency climate adaptation team that would be the mitigation team that you would be coordinating with?
The best answer to that I could give would be that the Next Generation Energy Act, and Will, I think you would be in a better position to answer this, but I mean, the state has definite energy goals. The Minnesota Department of Commerce and the MPCA and the EQB are all taking important roles as among other agencies in meeting these goals. It's not really being done on a more grassroots team basis like it is for adaptation. Mm-hmm. So I think that the state's ability to make progress has been more based on, you know, higher level policy decisions and regulatory and other decisions from the Department of Commerce and others. Will, would you?
Yeah, I think Paul articulated that pretty well. I mean, I think there's not a comparable structure, but there's pretty intensive interagency efforts that are a little bit more ad hoc based on the project. So, for instance, the Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities Project really has been a joint venture that's, you know, drawn on the expertise of probably over 60 staff throughout the enterprise. And a lot of the faces are the same in a lot of different similar climate mitigation type projects. We also have a energy and climate team that's been trying to, it was an energy and environment team in past years. Now it's more focused on energy and climate, and I think functionally it's trying to tackle that issue a little bit more operationally. So,
could I make one?
Kristen.
I just want to say that from a very small local, I'm from a township, that this the emphasis you put in some of your earlier things on green infrastructure education and co-benefit investments, those really speak to me very strongly at a very local level. I think those are really critical pieces for local government.
Other comments?
Could I just make a summary remark?
Sure.
On behalf of the team, I just wanted to thank the board very much for the opportunity to present. We'd be happy to present again. I think the suggestion of having local government representatives be a part of the presentation is a great one. Thanks particularly for your support, Commissioner Rothman. That was really nice to hear what you said about our team, and we really look forward to continuing to collaborate with all the commissioners and other members of the board in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our agenda. So with that, a motion to adjourn would be in order. There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carried. Meeting is adjourned.